This is David Duke. This is David Duke, and this is the David Duke Internet Web Radio Broadcast, broadcasting to the entire world with news and information of importance to Europeans and people of European descent wherever they may dwell upon the earth. And it's also certainly interesting to a lot of people who are not of European descent. And again, I will repeat this again and again and again, and that's a repetitive way of saying it as well, redundant actually. Ladies and gentlemen, I believe sincerely that my point of view is entirely consistent and unhypocritical. That is, I believe in my heritage, preserving my way of life, the expressions of our people, whether it be through the aesthetic expression, the visual expression of our people, the way that we have expressions in terms of our physical beauty, our spiritual values, our cultural heritage, our lineal heritage, every aspect of my European heritage I want to preserve. At the same time, I absolutely believe that every people on earth have this basic right to preserve their heritage. And I don't think that we need any sort of supremacism. Certainly the European people don't need any supremacism to do what we've done. We have become great because of the qualities and talents within our people. And it's true that every people historically have reached out. They have exercised their power. Nietzsche calls it a will to power, no question about it. And it's not just been European people. You know, there's a lot of negative connotations as to Europeans. Well, Europeans enslaved blacks. And Europeans, you know, committed this crime or that crime, or conquered Africa, or conquered India, or whatever. Well, certainly Europeans have, you know, done things which, in the light of today's morality or today's point of view, would have to be viewed as negative. But what Europeans did was no different in terms of moral basis than any other people have done. For instance, even in Africa today, African tribes who have a distinct ethnic derivation, they have a very distinct ethnic even character, height, body type, even often a psychological character. They fight one another. They vie for positions such as the Tutsi and the Hutu in Rwanda. And this has been going on since the beginning of time. It's always gone on. There's a lot of evidence today, for instance, that Europeans came to the Americas first. Some of the oldest specimens we have of human life in the Americas now turns out to be of Caucasian descent, Caucasian characteristics. You know, forensics, and many of you have probably always, a lot of you have seen these programs on television, like CSI or CIS, I don't know the name of it because I've never watched the program, but I do know it's about the use of forensics to solve crimes. And as you know by now, in fact, it's in the popular vernacular, many people understand and realize that you can literally, almost instantly, identify a particular person's race by the shape of the skull and by certain other biological markers. By the way, this naturally goes against the idea that race is a social construct, that race doesn't really exist. Well, when you can look at a skull and you can measure the different aspects, the certain thicknesses of the skull, the shape of the skull, the angles of the skull, and you can determine by that how the skull sutures, how it closes together, and you can determine by that shape and structure that a person is Asian, or a person is Caucasian, or a person is African, or a person even is mixed. You can almost do that. You can say this is a mixed race person. Of course, obviously, through DNA, you can determine whether a person is white, black, and if they're mixed, you can actually determine the mixture that exists within their own bloodstream. Now, a lot of people say that all races are mixed, and that's not really true. There's a certain percentage, certainly of whites in America, that have non-white blood. But the overwhelming majority of whites, you know, are purely European in terms of their descent. Their DNA shows that. There's Asians who have been even more isolated, and of course China is a nation with 1.3 billion people, and China is essentially all Chinese. There's very few minority groups, and what minority groups they have there are very tiny. They have this incredible biological unity, and that's one of the strengths of that country. Certainly it's one of the strengths of Japan, and it's one of the reasons why Japan, when they had these horrible earthquakes and massive destruction, even worse than Katrina, they almost had no looting. They certainly didn't have any people firing at helicopters. There wasn't this tremendous societal upheaval and disheveling of society. We have a very different situation in the United States. And if you look throughout history, different peoples end up conflicting on certain ideas. Now, liberals want to pretend that there are no differences among the races, that we're all exactly identical except for perhaps color of skin. Well, obviously, there are a lot of differences that lie deeper than that. Just as the forensic scientist, without even a strip of skin, without a single centimeter, a square centimeter of skin, can look at the bone structure of the skull or different aspects or just the DNA that's in the bone, and they can tell exactly whether the person is a white person or a black person. Race is a lot deeper than skin deep, goes a lot deeper than that. And, you know, the liberal or the person who is listening to this really Jewish supremacist propaganda, because that's who invented this whole process, as you know. The person who started the whole idea that race is simply a cultural aspect was Franz Boas. And that was a Jewish immigrant from Germany who did his doctoral thesis on the color of water. He also supported many Zionist causes, by the way, in his time, which is kind of interesting as well. Almost all of his students, Melville Hershkovitz, Ashley Montague, whose real name was Israel Ehrenberg, by the way, but he adopted that English moniker, I guess, to make his ideas flow a little smoother into the European-American and the European community in general. We can go on and on. And, of course, they did have a token black person in there, Kenneth Clark. They also had a token feminist in there. But the truth is that the overwhelming majority of the so-called egalitarian science that pervaded our universities and was popularized by the media. Again, you have that collusion, you have that tremendous Jewish power in media, and you have this team effort. So, you know, Franz Boas, even though his ideas were absolutely ludicrous, and they still are ludicrous, even though his ideas were ludicrous, you had the Jewish influence in the media telling the world how great that Franz Boas was, what a fantastic intellect, and how his ideas were so current and so prescient and so fantastically intelligent, and this was the real scientific truth. And in the universities, you had the same kind of thing going on with his team effort. And in university after university, you had physical anthropology, which was in many ways based on the physical aspects of differences between the races. That was one of the main concerns of physical anthropology and around the world. You know, they looked and they studied the differences in mankind and the physiological differences and how the races evolved and the effects of and definitely evolution or the development of different races affected racial characteristics dramatically. So naturally, physical anthropology was really a study of the development of races in mankind. You can't study mankind and the development of mankind without studying that principle. In some ways, you could say even some of the earlier versions of humanity were races rather than, in fact, species. For instance, Cro-Magnon man as compared to Neanderthal man. They could actually interbreed. I mean, the evidence is that they could interbreed and have offspring, just the way a black person and a white person can interbreed. But they had very distinct differences. And eventually, Cro-Magnon man in Europe became the dominant people, and they later became what we call, you know, the Indo-European people who really brought us Western civilization and these other aspects that we so revere today. But Franz Boas, you know, again, Ashley Montague, Gene Wellfish, Melville Hershkovitz, And we can go on down to the modern day. You know, Mr. Gould was one of the greatest proponents of so-called egalitarianism. Jared Diamond, one of the Jewish proponents of egalitarianism, who, by the way, who always tells us that race is a social construct and it's not really reality. And yet in an Anthropology Today article, he talks about how great it is that we have DNA now so we can determine who the real Jews are, so that Israel can determine who to let into their country or not. Again, a Jewish supremacist telling Gentiles, essentially for our consumption, that there's no such thing as race. You can go into Mr. Rose, you can go to Mr. Lowenton, I can just continue on and on. They absolutely dominated the egalitarian sciences. Now, there are a few Jews, I must admit, who are counter the egalitarian point of view, and I must hand it to them. But there's no question about the fact that the overwhelming power of the egalitarian movement was led and controlled and dominated and empowered by Jewish supremacism and the Jewish alliance with that in terms of media, money, government, and other aspects that they utilized in promoting this program. You have to understand, this is what, I guess I'm talking to some liberals here. You know, we had a very nice conversation, I think, the limited one that we had with Judy on the person, the lady of Jewish descent on the program the other night on Current Issues TV. And we've had some nice dialogue since then in emails. And I think she's coming to understand me a little bit more. But she's typical of many of these liberals. They don't even realize that they've pretty much been programmed by some of the Jewish supremacists. And the idea, ladies and gentlemen, is this, that if the Jewish supremacists, who are very tightly wound racist, and I tell you this, that Judaism and Jewish supremacism and Zionism is the most virulent, the ultimate form of racial supremacism on the planet. And I will say that without one smidgen of hesitation. Because if you take a look at it, there's no, you know, racial viewpoint that is as tough as the Jewish viewpoint. For instance, the Cohen class, or the Kohanim, which is the theoretically, and I don't know how practical this is, but it's the theoretical priest class of the Jewish people, like the elite. It's kind of like the SS of the Jews. And in their scripture and in their, you know, in their writings and so forth, the Kohanim are, you know, that's like the ultimate. And the Kohens, so to speak, is what that really comes from. They are not permitted in the Jewish religion to have one smidgen of Gentile blood. Any person with the tiniest smidgen of Gentile blood cannot be part of that elite. As I often say, the SS in Germany, all they had to do was prove their purity 6 generations back or 8 generations back. The Kohanim, you know, must not have ever had any. Of course, it's hard for them to prove that, but anyway, that's the reality of it. And in Israel, which is the living expression of this Jewish supremacism, and that's when people tell me that the Jewish supremacists are just a tiny minority. Well, let me tell you, they dominate Israel because the government of Israel. I have articles on my website, davidduke.com, as you know, where it actually states in there. Specifically, I've got quotations from Haaretz magazine, a newspaper, many other Jewish publications, where they literally talk about the fact that the Israeli government won't even allow a Kohanim, or whatever you want to call it. I don't know how they pronounce their particular title. They won't even allow this particular segment of Jewry to marry another Jew who might have a bit, you know, a tiny percentage of Gentile blood. And there was a case specifically of a Kohanim who was not allowed to marry a Jewish girl who was shown to have some Gentile ancestry, even though she was a practicing Jew. And, of course, Israel does not legally recognize in Israel the marriage of a Jew and a non-Jew. And, of course, Israel is based on the idea that if you can return to Israel by Jewish descent, you can be an atheist. Now, it's true, yes, that you have some converts to Judaism, and some spouses who are allowed to immigrate to Israel, but it's a tiny, tiny percentage. That's not, you know, the basis of the state, and they are able to, you know, I guess accept that to a degree. But the overwhelming aspect, in fact, many, maybe even half or more of the people coming into Israel aren't even religious Jews. In fact, there's been many studies done that the great majority of the Jewish people in Israel are, in fact, non-believers. In fact, one of the most shocking studies I ever read is that a majority of Jews in Israel don't even believe in God. And yet, of course, many of them still, you know, attend synagogue or are members of synagogue, and they support this Orthodox Jewish state. Why? Because Orthodox Jewry is really ultimately a racial team effort. It is a racial religion. As people know that in Jewry and Judaism, you don't even have a guarantee or an assurance of afterlife. And I can quote many, many famous Jews on that subject. Now, some Jews believe that there may be a resurrection at some time, but there's no, you know, there's no guarantees. The average Jew, even the religious Jew, doesn't really believe in an afterlife. You live on in the memories of your friends. That's what they really believe. Now, that's really odd for a major religion in the world. And it's the kind of religion where the group gains power on the earth. It's a worldly religion. It's about attaining power on the earth, amassing wealth, influence, strength, power, influence. On this planet. And it's not traditionally like the other religions. And you have the strange affairs such as in the Talmud where rabbis will be talked about as debating with God and then winning the debate. They have a very strange view about God. And Judaism has a great deal of tolerance in terms of some of these beliefs. A great deal of tolerance. It's amazing how much tolerance that they actually do possess in Judaism for people as long as they're of Jewish descent. And rabbis will have a complete, some rabbis even basically take almost an atheist point of view, but they're still rabbis. I never understood that. But it's just a strange phenomena, but it really exists. It's really a racial religion. That's what Judaism is. And so when people see, when some of my Palestinian friends, and a lot of people have listened to all this propaganda, and a lot of our, as Lenin said, you know, we're going to lead the opposition to defeat. And few people even realize today that Lenin himself had a significant Jewish heritage. He was at least a quarter Jewish, and if not half Jewish, in terms of, or more, in terms of his ancestry. And I can show you Jewish magazines that talk about that. But Lenin said, we'll lead the opposition to defeat. And a lot of people say, well, you know, we're not against Judaism, and we don't have any problem with Judaism. It's the Zionists we have a problem with. Well, let me tell you something. Judaism, you know, and I, again, I don't object to Jews through their religion or anything else trying to promote their own people. That is a natural situation, to want your heritage to go on, your traditions to go on, your songs and your stories and your values and all the rest of it. But the difference about Judaism is completely antagonistic. It's really a religion primarily based on hatred of Gentiles. Even I think that's even more dominant than any so-called love of the Jewish people. Yeah, they do say that they're the chosen people of God, but if you really look at Judaism, just take a look at their holidays. Right? What's their major holidays? You've got Hanukkah, which is about a religious, you know, it's actually about military victory against the Assyrians, the Greeks, and the recapturing of the temple. Of course, you know the story about the lamp burning for 7 days. And the Jews themselves will talk about that, and they'll say the meaning of Hanukkah is that Hanukkah symbolizes the resistance of Jews to assimilation, that the Greeks weren't trying to hurt the Jewish people. They weren't trying to exterminate or commit genocide against the people. But no, the genocide that was taking place was the Jews could have assimilated with the Greeks. See, the Greeks were open. The Greeks allowed the Jews to flourish in their empire. Even the Romans did. And, of course, even Christians didn't concern themselves about descent. While the Jews themselves, they were concerned about assimilation. That was their ultimate concern, and that was about a military victory. The other great Jewish holiday, of course, and there's two other really powerful ones other than the Jewish New Year and a few of the other things, but the other great Jewish holiday is Passover, certainly one of the main ones in their history and heritage. And that just brims with hatred against the Egyptians, against the Pharaoh. They say the Pharaoh is trying to exterminate them, and then they celebrate basically the passing over the evil spirit over their doors and striking down the firstborn of the Egyptian children. I mean, that's actually a celebration of infanticide. I'm sorry, infanticide. I mean, it's just an absolute, an amazing thing. But then, you know, I know a lot of people don't look at it that way. I mean, as a Christian, I look at a lot of these things differently. You know, and I think that Christ really fulfilled the law, and he went kind of, you know, about a more of a loving attitude toward people. But Passover is really a situation. It's the passing over of this spirit, this deadly spirit that struck down the first of the Egyptian children, And so it didn't strike down the Jewish children. It was a way to try to weaken or get back at the Pharaoh. Then you have Purim, which is a celebration of the massacre of Haman, and people are so amazed about these things. I mean, people don't even know, what is this holiday that the Jews celebrate in Purim? Well, the Jews say, and we don't know whether this is true or not, but what the Jewish supremacists say, that Haman had a plot to kill or wipe out the Jews of his kingdom in Persia, that he was going to kill the Jews. Now, we don't know whether that's true or not, but the Jews rose up and killed Haman, hung his 12 sons, and in fact killed about 76,000 Persians. One of the biggest massacres. In fact, if you read the book of Esther, it's one of the bloodiest books of the Old Testament, in fact. And there's a lot of questions whether Esther should be in the Old Testament. There was a big discussion about that when the biblical process, when the selection of the books of the Old Testament was going on in the Middle Ages. But if you take a look at this, it's brimming. In fact, the traditions about Haman probably hasn't been replaced by any hateful figures until maybe Hitler, maybe Saddam Hussein a little bit too. But Haman is mentioned in so much of Jewish literature, and there's just so much vile hatred. During the time of Purim, the Jewish children beat the willow trees, willow branches actually. And this literally, I can show you this from Jewish writings, and it's there in Jewish supremacism for those who want to check this out. I can show you in Jewish writings where they literally say that this symbolizes the beating of Haman. Now, what kind of religion has a bunch, is this a religion of love when you have a bunch of children in church beating the willow, symbolizing the beating of your enemies? Is this a religion of universal love and forgiveness? And even at the time of Purim, you have these delicious little tasties, these little snacks that are created in the Jewish community. In literally tens of thousands of parties and gatherings for Purim around the world, celebrations for Purim around the world in Jewish communities. Now, they have some very interesting little delicacies that the participants of these little celebrations, and this is whether you're talking about Reform, whether you're talking about Orthodox, and by the way, a lot of people talk about Reform. Reform is only popular really in America. The rest of the Jewish world is almost entirely Orthodox, by the way, as far as religion is concerned. But what are the little delicacies that they eat at Purim? Well, believe it or not, one of the delicacies they eat is called Haman Tashin. And what that literally means is, in their vernacular, is Haman's ears. And I can show you this on major Jewish websites. Haman's ears, like a pastry, and they do it in a triangular shape, which symbolizes Haman's ears. They're eating the ears, their body parts, of their enemy. There is another incredibly strange delicacy they practice, and it's called kreplach. And kreplach is like a dough-filled pocket. It's made of dough. It's a dough pocket filled with ground beef, pulverized ground beef. Well, ladies and gentlemen, believe it or not, the ground beef symbolizes the beaten flesh of Haman. Do you believe me? Does that sound too crazy, too radical, too extreme, too unbelievably barbaric to be true? That's absolutely true. In Jewish supremacism, I give the citations and the sources of this, and it's all over the internet. You can go to kosher cooking, and you can find different sections on the internet by Jewish sources where they even talk about kreplach. And this ground, they take ground beef, and it symbolizes the beaten flesh of Haman. Now, how is it that these people can actually eat the beaten flesh of Haman? Now, people wonder about all this. They always call it blood libel. And the old stories about ritual murder were, during the Middle Ages, certain radical Jews would kidnap Gentile children and then bleed them. And they would take the blood, and they would mix it in their dough, and they used this as a symbol, as like a satanic or a vicious symbol of their power of the Gentiles. Now, the Jews have always claimed, or at least to the Gentile world, that this was absolutely false, that this never really occurred, and wasn't prominent. But it was believed all over the Christian world. There are wood carvings of the so-called ritual murder where the Gentile children are being held over a pot and their throats are slit and so forth for this satanic ritual. And there have been some cases, such as the Belus case. It's a perfect example in what was at that point very Western Russia. And the evidence was overwhelming that Belus had actually kidnapped Gentile children and did some sort of satanic rites with them. But I'm not saying here that Jewish ritual murder took place to any great degree. But I am telling you that a lot of Gentiles and Gentile children have been abused. The pornography racket, for instance, is absolutely overwhelmingly controlled by Jews and people that support the Jewish extremist and the Jewish supremacist agenda. And there was one ring, for instance, that in Russia was kidnapping Gentile children and actually killing them and sexually abusing them on video, and then selling these tapes to perverts around the world. In fact, one of the major Italian public news broadcasting companies exposed this. In fact, the Jewish head of one of these companies fired the people who exposed this plot. This is an absolutely true rendition, I'm telling you, ladies and gentlemen. I'm not exaggerating one bit. You know, and so whether or not they do it in some satanic ritual, I can tell you that there are so many of our children's blood on their hands. And I think that the presentation and the promotion, for instance, of this child pornography and all sorts of other perverted pornographies. You know, pornography has a way when a person's young and they get involved in this, and of course it starts generally in adolescence where people have very strong sex drives. And a lot of times kids are pimply and skinny and they can't necessarily get a natural outlet for their sexual desires. And at that time, they're very vulnerable to often getting perverted forms of sexual satisfaction or sexual enjoyment. And they're very vulnerable. It's one reason why that I think some of the, especially the sick aspects of it, you know, it's one thing for something to be titillating. There's always been some very, very, erotic art and even literature in Western civilization. Why not? You have Jewish influence. I mean, same with some of the Greeks. Sculptures are certainly very beautiful and almost sexual in terms of showing the beauty of the human body. And there's nothing really wrong with that. That's a natural thing. I don't necessarily agree with the old ways of the church during the Middle Ages when they put on this false leaves and other coverings over the private parts of people. But the Greeks represented the human body as it truly was, and the Romans too. They thought it was a work of art and beauty and a natural thing. But the modern pornographers, again, which is shown by the article I have about Dr. Abrams, which is on my site, a Jewish researcher, what they've really done is they developed all these absolutely perverted forms of pornography. And these have a way of addicting people, and they have a way of, and because people need more and more excitement in many cases, they go to more and more extremes. Now, when you have a lot of pornography, obviously showing a lot of sadomasochism and just terrible, degrading types of things, and if people need this to get off, if they need this to have some sort of sexual satisfaction, you can understand how this will promote acts, you know, heinous acts against individuals, children or others or women in the world. And look what we have. I mean, if you look at the rates of kidnappings, for instance, I remember when it was. I remember in the 1950s, and when I could go to the store, you know, as a 7 or 8 or 9 year old little boy or girl, and go to and from home from school, and my parents wouldn't worry about me being kidnapped and being abused in some capacity. Look how America has changed, and it's changed directly as we've allowed, and this pornographic stuff has increased. And it's not a coincidence, ladies and gentlemen. It's an absolute connected phenomenon. I remember the quotation from Al Goldstein, one of the big pornographers of this country, who, by the way, is now working as a restaurant and a greeter in another Jewish restaurant in New York. But I remember one of the quotations. He said, literally, one reason why he loved pornography, because it was a FU against Christianity, an FU against Jesus Christ, and an FU against authoritarianism of the, you know, really the, it was an FU against the white world. That's essentially what he was saying. And I've seen this in so many places. I mean, it's the same kind of a drive that causes Rabbi Shmuley, you know, who's a big supporter of the Likud in Israel and segregated Israeli settlements and land they've stolen from the Palestinians, to go to Utah and say, well, we've got to integrate the white community there. Now, how can the man do that? You know, I think that a lot of Jews get this satisfaction of seeing the degradation of our people. It's kind of like a ritual murder in a sense. It's like a stylized form of ritual murder. You know, when they see that the beautiful, bright, you know, light-skinned, fair, European-American woman in the hands of, you know, one of the a gangster rapper or whatever, you know, they get a satisfaction. They really promote this image. They basically could turn on MTV, which again is Mr. Murray Rothstein, Redstone is his changed name, like so many of them do change their names. You know, he promotes this garbage. He basically tells our young women that, you know, man, you got to get older, and if you're lucky, maybe you can get yourself a black gangster rapper as a boyfriend. And what is gangster rap anyway? Isn't it a terrible attack on womanhood and decency and really an attack against white people per se? And yet this has become stylish. In fact, rap music's promoted and everything. And by the way, this is an entirely Jewish-promoted thing. The blacks didn't make rap music popular. What made rap music popular was the Jewish record producers who popularized it. It was the Jewish extremist-controlled magazines, you know, which promoted this. Even the teen magazines, which told the young people, this is what's cool, this is what's cool. It was things like MTV. It was things like the mass media that promoted this and capitalized on it and made many hundreds of millions of dollars on this as well, in addition to destroying the vitality, you know, of many of our young people and the sense of well-being of so many of our young people. And just like the article by Dr. Abrams shows, you know, my God, pornography. It's one thing for pornography to be in a few pictures, you know, that Uncle Ray kept in a drawer of his, you know, or hidden back in the closet, to now pornography has become a mainstream thing. And this could not have been mainstream except for the fact that the media didn't make an approbation about this. Just as the media has not made a serious approbation about what has happened to the Palestinians. And the Palestinians have been murdered, they've been terrorized, they've been driven from their homes, they've been tortured by the hundreds of thousands. Israel is a state with nuclear weapons, with biological weapons. Israel has even been designing biological viruses that are targeted against certain races. That is like the very worst scenario someone could imagine about the National Socialists and the Nazis of the Second World War. Israel's doing this today. There's lots of evidence that Israel's doing this. Instead, we've got to hear about Saddam Hussein's non-existent weapons of mass destruction because he's an enemy of Israel, and we don't hear diddly squat about Jewish weapons of mass destruction and the real threat to world peace. And who's got this finger on the trigger of these weapons? People like Ariel Sharon. I have a great quote in there by Amos Oz, which is a Jewish journalist in my book. And he quotes Ariel Sharon where he talks about even using these weapons against Europe if necessary. I mean, it's frightening. And he talks about, in that interview, he talks about the fact that perhaps the Palestinians, you know, all the way to Euphrates should have been ethnically cleansed, killed. You know, he says maybe, you know, so what, they'd say a few bad things about us, but here we'd have, you know, a fantastic, powerful world Israeli state, you know, if this would have been done. This is Ariel Sharon. This is the man who is the head of Israel today. He's a mass murderer. He's a criminal. All right? He's a mass murdering war criminal. But there's no objection to this in the media, just like there was no real objection in the mainstream Jewish media as pornography found its way. And so interesting, you know, the people who promoted pornography were saying, well, my God, we got to have pornography, should be legal. That's fine. It's on the basis of freedom of speech. And I'll tell you something, 40 years ago, we had freedom of speech, political freedom of speech. In all of Europe, you could say what you wanted to say. They wouldn't put you in jail for disputing something of the Holocaust 50 years ago, or saying something negative about Israel, or saying something about anything. In fact, they got a law in England they're trying to get passed and through right now where it puts you in jail for up to 7 years for saying something insulting about another religion. Does anybody want to go back to the Inquisition, ladies and gentlemen, where they put you in jail for blasphemy? Is it much different? How about any comedian, any show, say that you have a program and it shows you, you know, some fallacies of religion, or you talk about that in your classroom, you're a scientist, and you say, well, maybe I don't think the earth was created before the stars, because how could the light from the stars get to the Earth? You know how many millions of years it takes for even light to travel across the huge distances of the planets? You know, they could say that you're insulting and you're saying something negative about a religion by that basis. I mean, it's like a new inquisition, ladies and gentlemen. So political speech and religious speech and the freedom to criticize and the freedom to contest and the freedom to, quote, offend, it's a pretty good way to put it, the freedom to offend, and that's what freedom of speech is all about. Everybody's going to be offended. If people are not offended, you don't have to worry about freedom of speech. You don't need laws to protect freedom of speech. Right? If you say something innocuous, if you simply say the sky is blue, you have no problem. You know, but you say the sky is green and people have, that's against their religious view or some sort of other view, then that person might be put in jail. Being offensive is that. But freedom of speech, and I believe absolutely in freedom of political thought and speech and expression that way. You know, I don't believe in complete freedom for some of the worst and most horrible forms of pornography. I don't think that's what our children should be seeing. I don't think that's what our society is going to be healthy doing. I'm not a prude, you know, but there has to be some sort of standards. But instead, now you've got the rankest and the weirdest pornography that you could possibly imagine, pervasive in all kinds of community. You can turn on your cable television in the evening, any child could do it for that matter, and see the worst and the rankest types of sadomasochist and hateful and degrading pornographic. Even the slasher movies, ladies and gentlemen, I don't agree with. I'm sorry. You know, we've always had a degree of people in our society who have been crazy, you know, who've been mental cases or schizophrenic cases and so forth. And I think one of the reasons why we had this mass increase in these weird murders and these strange cases and dismemberments and cannibalism and the rest of it is because they see it in the movies. You didn't used to see that. Go back to the 60s, 50s, 40s, and you had some bad guys. You had a gangster kill someone, often they didn't even show you the blood. You know, but it, you know, you didn't have things like the Texas Chainsaw Massacres with arms hanging up and the blood spurting out and all the rest of it. And that wouldn't even have been allowed then. And you didn't have the camera in the eye of the predator. So the person watching the picture who, you know, is trying to express and are trying to view this thing. You didn't have that. Let me see what this is. I've got a few things going on here. I'm trying to get some adjusters for some of this damage to the property that has some insurance. And by the way, we've been working today, and we've got another volunteer working right out now at the house, and we're going to probably need some volunteers this weekend. So if you'd like to come on to Covington or Mandeville this weekend, you know, I would love for you to come. It would be really great. So okay, I'm going to take that later. So anyway, so getting back to the subject, I mean, it's so now we have a situation which, and all the people who talked about freedom of speech, our founding fathers, they never had any consideration that pornography would be allowed. They were talking about, you know, political, social, religious thought, and there were many people in those ages and those times who the founding fathers really supported, who were saying things that they didn't agree with. Most of the founding fathers were pretty religious men. Some weren't. Some were just deist. But Thomas Paine said many, many things against the church and many, many things even against Christianity. But they viewed Paine as a great patriot, and they allowed him to publish his tracts. Nobody even thought about putting Thomas Paine in prison for daring to say what he said. And he wrote a lot of things. Our founding fathers believed in political, social, and religious freedom, that you had the right to say what you believe. But today, now, we have this massive, sick pornography that's promoted. And again, we have terrible conditions in society. We have, how many people have been killed because of this and murdered and atrocities? And how many women have been abused and children been abused? It goes on and on and on. And I believe in freedom, but I obviously believe that we must have standards, and that's one of the problems. Now people can say, well, you know, we'd still have this pornography if it weren't for the Jewish influence. Would we really? I don't think we would. I really don't think. I think in our left to our own society that Gentile Christians would not have created this incredible blight and on the consciousness, on the spirit of our people. I do not believe that would have taken place. And if you take a look at it from the very beginning, they dominated this industry. They dominated their own, even the Jewish media that didn't actually create the pornography itself. The Jewish extremist media supported those Jews who did and tried to shield them from prosecution and held up the arguments about freedom of speech. Of course, as soon as it came to someone criticizing them, those Gentiles were attacked like crazy, and now they've been working toward hate laws. In Canada, if my book goes into Canada, Jewish Supremacism, which exposes Jewish hatred and Jewish extremism and Jewish racism, that my book is burned. My book is burned, and it's just you know. But at the same time, in Canada, you can buy any sort of buy films that show that show women being defecated upon. You see, ladies and gentlemen, what I'm driving at. We live in a very, very distorted and evil time, and it's not the kind of society that I want my children to grow up in, our grandchildren, our great grandchildren. And I really believe that someday we will have a society, we'll have a country, we'll have a world. And I can't be responsible for the world, but I can certainly speak about our European countries. And I believe someday we'll have a nation where there won't be hardly any of this sick pornography. That a child will go to school and he'll learn what honor means and duty and courage and how to behave in an honorable way toward each other and towards his society and towards his country. He'll learn honor, duty, courage, honesty, you know, and being upright about things. He'll be taught to have a healthy body and a healthy mind, and not just this half hour of casual calisthenics, which most people sit around in half of the gymnasiums in America, the public schools, and smoke or eat candy in their gym class, but a strong, rigorous health and fitness situation. You know, we won't be feeding our kids all this candy and sweets and caffeine. We'll be feeding our kids, you know, healthy foods, you know, proteins and decent foods. And healthy vegetables and health and tasty things, but healthy things, that we won't have this massive advertisement, for instance, of where drinking soda is down. We have this massive number of children now who are developing diabetes and getting sick. You know, I think, again, I do think government has a role in all that, ladies and gentlemen. Has a role. People can do what they want. If someone wants to get a Coca-Cola and drink 5 Coca-Colas, fine, but I don't believe that Coca-Cola should be promoted to our young kids, all right? And to drink. I think we've got to have a whole revolution in the way that we treat ourselves, okay? I have a Coca-Cola once in a while, but let me tell you something. When you have this supersized Coca-Cola and you have this all these commercials on television and it's cool to drink Cokes and soft drinks and all the rest of it, you know, look what's going on. We didn't have massive obesity in our children just a few years ago, or in even adults a few years ago. And at the same time, now we've got all the diet drinks, which are full of aspartame and all lots of terrible, terrible chemicals, which are very dangerous for you as well. We had a different lifestyle and a different value system than what we have today. And people can say, oh, yes, it's free enterprise, and they can do whatever they want, sell whatever they want, and promote whatever they want on the media. Well, let me tell you, I don't believe that. I believe in free enterprise, yes, I believe in, but I think there's got to be societal responsibility. You know, and I really believe that when you have a society, let's take a look at media for a second, you have a very tiny number of people who create most of the media available in the world, most of the media. Just a handful, a couple of thousand people, basically. And most of these people, they're not elected. They have no input to the public. They have no concern for the public. They do what they want. They create what they want. They want to promote gangster rap, they do it. And this is mass media. There's only a very few major cable networks, only a major few broadcasting companies, only a very few even film production companies in America. And to get your film distributed, only a very handful of companies that really can distribute your film or even your book across the United States of America. And I think there's got to be a role somewhere. I think the public has to have some sort of input. These people, like Solzhenitsyn said it so well. He said, by whom were these people elected, and to whom are they responsible? Amen. By whom were they elected? To whom are they responsible? And I believe in a complete revolution, ladies and gentlemen, of my country. I believe we've got to start getting the best of our people, the very best of our people, you know, into the positions of leadership. And I think we've got to completely revise our whole the way that we elect people. Forget the mass television commercials. I mean, again, on television and film, it looks like Superman can really fly. It looks like Spider-Man can shoot some gooey thread out of his fingertips and jump from building to building. Of course, in reality, he can't do that. And by the way, we've had a few interruptions in our broadcast stream during this program, but the thing will be complete again. The thing will be complete again in our archives. So if you missed any part of it, you can get it back and hear it and deal with it. But anyway, that's the way it is. I really ramble on and on. I better take some of the emails for a minute. We're doing so many things. And, you know, I missed Bush today. He was in Covington building a house, the Habitat for Humanity. I wish I'd have been able to go over and see Bush and hold up a picket sign, but we didn't find out about him too late. We're building our own place, fixing the roof where three major trees. You should see the pictures of these trees. I mean, huge, huge. I mean, so one of them had, I think, 94 rings. Beautiful old pine trees, longleaf pines, just beautiful trees. And to think of these pines, I can't believe they didn't go all the way down the house to the foundation. We really appreciate everybody out here, and I appreciate everybody that's. In fact, we got volunteers right now working on the house in Covington, and I appreciate that so much because that enables us to do our work very well. There are people doing drywall right now. If some people want to come out and help us this weekend, you know, they're welcome to come. Send me an email if you'd like to do that, and we'll get in touch with you and give you some directions. And we have enough space. You can lay down a sleeping bag, and it'll be quite comfortable if you can sleep on a hard surface. But we do have a place for you to sleep if you need it. And so that's the situation there. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, let me go to Stormfront. Catch the shoutcast. We got so much stuff going on here. All right. Here we go, Town Hall. Hey, in fact, I've got to go see one of the properties right now and put my shoulder into it for a while. We've got a lot of work to do, and I've got much work to do. I've got some other speaking engagements waiting for me, and I've got to get this thing finished and so I can get going and do the work of what I need to do. There's been a lot of discussion on different uses of symbols and everything, and let me tell you something. Here's my view on symbols. To me, symbols, and I love certain symbols of our heritage, and I understand exactly what all the symbols of our heritage and our heroes throughout history have been. At the same time, I know what politics is about. And one of the men that so many people admire on Stormfront and other places, when he selected the symbols that he used symbols that were positive in the eyes of the people. A symbol that represented good luck and prosperity. And was attractive, and it didn't have any negative connotation. And I believe if those individual leaders of the past were present in the political process or the process of changing men's minds, I think they too would choose symbols, you know, that are not only negative, but they're essentially positive in their structure, that they have something in them that is common to people's heritage, and some people can hang on to that way, and that don't have negative connotations. Now, I realize that we can't make our choices for symbols totally by what our enemies do, but we have to realize who dominates the media in the world, and we've got to deal with the realities there. And sometimes, you know, we have to structure some of our approach in terms, not our philosophy. And one man said it so well when he said that, you know, our philosophy, our ideals, our ideas are absolutely immutable, cannot be changed, but our tactics must be flexible. You know, I think our symbols, as one person said, can be won back, but I think it's going to be our people when they come to power. They're going to make some of those symbols come back. Because that's not what's going to change the world this time, ladies and gentlemen. You have to be able to reach people, and you have to be able to open the door to people. And if you use symbols, and again, there's a pro and con of everything, and some controversial symbols obviously give people an interest, and that makes it interesting for people. But there's so many people, and the problem is that most people are not open-minded. Or if they are open-minded, it's kind of a conditional open-mindedness. So it's important for you, ladies and gentlemen, and I believe, not to make any additional barriers for people. What you say can be controversial enough. You see, that's what I believe. Joseph Morgan says it repulses, talking about certain symbols, it repulses 99% of people we want to reach. Our goal is not to rehabilitate a symbol, but to free our people. I agree with that principle. And I also agree with the idea. We can't back off entirely. You know, there's some people who might even want to give up the Confederate flag. But again, how bad can they say about the Confederate flag? They can't. You know, the truth is they don't, you know, again, they can do that to a certain point. I would be reluctant to make a movement symbol for people both North and South to be simply a Confederate flag, because that would certainly alienate a lot of people with their ancestry. Even though I respect the Confederate flag, and we certainly use it, but the Confederate flag is a hell of a lot different than a lot of the symbols that they present to us today. At least it's an American phenomenon. It has part in American history, but it's very difficult. You know, it's just as I talked to Jean-Michel Girard when he came down to Louisiana to our conference, and you know, he can't. You know, if you're going to get nationalists in a particular country, you don't put the battle flag of one of your nation's traditional enemies on the wall. That doesn't get people to go out and support you and vote for you politically. You have enough barriers in front of you to do that. You really do. And you know, let's talk about the positive. Let's deal. You can say plenty of controversial things about a lot of issues. That's certainly easy, and that brings controversy. You can say, you know, the only terrorist nation, the only nation in the Middle East, the only government of any nation in the Middle East that's attacked America with terroristic attacks has been Israel. Boy, that's controversial. That's great. And that opens the door. But don't be in a situation where they can compartmentalize you. The Jewish extremists have worked for years to compartmentalize people. And I think there is a big difference with the Confederate flag in the sense that the Confederate flag, that still, for most conscious people, European-American, racially conscious people in America, is in many ways a positive symbol. It's kind of a symbol of our heritage, and it's a symbol of resistance to tyranny. And so I think there is a difference there. But I don't, again, the same point, I don't think that, you know, if I wanted to have that as my main symbol, I would be League of the South or something. But again, we don't need disunity in our cause. We need to bring white people together, whether we're Northern or Southern or whatever. And at most of my conferences, I've always had, in addition to other flags, Confederate flags, as part of our American heritage here, no question about it. But I would never put it in the situation, this would be our symbol, because that's not really what we're trying to do. We certainly, you know, I love the South. Man, I'm a Confederate from way back. And when I was a young boy growing up in South Louisiana, I can't tell you how dedicated we were to the personalities of Lee and Jefferson Davis and Stonewall Jackson and Nathan Bedford Forrest and all those men. We loved those individuals. And let me tell you something, I still love them today. And their examples of courage and heroism and honor still inspire me today. But as one person said earlier in one of these posts, you know, our job right now is not to rehabilitate a symbol. Our job is to reach our people and educate them of the fact that our people are being destroyed. And that if Jewish supremacism continues to flourish in our land and on this earth, all heritage and cultures will be destroyed along with ours, all cultures. That we'll lose our freedom, we'll lose our heritage, we'll lose our very existence on this planet, and that we have a right to live. Ladies and gentlemen, I've gone way over time today. I know we've had a couple interruptions and breaks in our broadcast, But we'll certainly, I'll be back with you tomorrow. I appreciate everything you're doing, and I'm hoping to be back with you on time tomorrow. There's a lot going on with the Covington House. Again, I'm suggesting to those people who want to help us and support us, we've had a very thin time the last 2 months, very little contributions. In fact, our website was down again for 2 days, as you know, this last weekend. And if you ever thought about making a contribution or ordering a copy of Jewish Supremacism or My Awakening or a set of DVDs of the conference, which are absolutely incredible, they look like film. It's just beautifully done. Now, the whole set, regular $100, is only $65. If you ever thought about doing that, I would really hope that you do it right now because the funds are necessary. If you want to make a contribution, we need them right now. We've had a couple, you know, we've had a few thousand, and not just a couple, a few thousand dollars worth of damage, and we've got work to do, and we need your support on that. And I'm not bashful in saying so. And by helping us there, you're also helping us do our work. And I would tell you something. I'm not ashamed to say, I'm very proud to say, I don't think anybody or any group in the movement for our heritage and culture has done more per dollar than what we've done. Now, if you notice on my websites, I'm in America right now taking care of these issues. I'm not writing quite as much as I did when I was overseas or in Europe on the road. When I'm on the road, I just concentrate everything on my writing, my books, also the articles. And as soon as I get back to that, you know, you'll be seeing more and more articles on my website. But if you take a look at the website over the last few months, you'll see more speaking appearances to more new people, more interviews in the media all over America and all over the world. You know, literally hundreds of thousands of words that I've written over the last year or two for our cause. I think very effective words. We need your support, and we can't exist without it. And we've had a very difficult time with Hurricane Katrina and the fact we had no mail and we had no electricity, no computers, and no means of getting your support during this time, but the bills keep coming in. So thanks a lot. I appreciate those of you. And those of you who can come to Covington and give us a hand, please do so. We're also making a little gift, you know, of T-shirts, sometimes hats and other aspects we have of Euro and other of our materials for those that come out and volunteer as a little thank you. But we'd love to have you come out and support us. And let's go to work. And let's get this material out there, ladies and gentlemen. We've got to do that. We definitely have to do that. Thank you so much. And I'm going to go ahead and sign off, and I'll see you tomorrow. Thank you so much. Bye-bye now.
This has been David Duke for our heritage and our freedom.